This is Jim Semivan, and you are listening to That UFO Podcast.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to That UFO Podcast. On the show with me today, I have a returning guest and a brand new guest I'm very excited to speak to. First up, the new guest, I've got Kelly Chase. You will know her as the creator and host of the UFO Rabbit Hole Podcast and, of course, co-founder of Ontocalypse Productions. Hi to Kelly.
Hi, Andy. I'm thrilled to be here. Thanks for having me.
Wonderful to have you. I've not done the two guest thing for a while, so I've said hi to you. Now I'm going to speak to, you know, old hat now. Jay's done this a few times. I've got Jay Christopher King, director of the Experiencer Group and co-founder of Ontocalypse Productions as well. A man of many hats, much like Kelly is these days, with many, many, you know, rings in the fire, however you want to say it. Jay, welcome back.
Great to be here. Great to be back, Andy. Thanks so much for having me. And it's wonderful to see Kelly and Andy here. This is fantastic.
You see Kelly a lot more often than I do, obviously being over in the States and working together. And that working together is one of the reasons I want to get you both on to speak. You are, of course, both speakers at this year's Contact in the Desert. We'll get to that at the end of the show. Ticket links are in the description and all that good stuff. But first up, quick intros for you from you both. For anyone who may not be familiar with either of you from either previous appearances like Jay or Kelly, if someone's listening or watching, many will know you from your own work on the UFO Rabbit Hole Podcast. But please, Kelly, first, a little bit about yourself and what brings you to the UFO dance.
Yeah, so like you said, I'm the host of the UFO Rabbit Hole. I've been doing that for a few years now. It's been an incredible ride. You know, just becoming a part of this UFO community, I came in, as I've shared on my show a lot, as a skeptic, and have become more than a believer. This has become my whole life, and I'm thrilled to be doing it. And I'm also, as you mentioned, the co-founder of Ontocalypse Productions, which I'm sure we'll talk about some more, that I co-founded along with Jay and our good friend and CFO of the company, Jordan Flowers, who's a really bright and interesting guy in his own right. So I'm just really kind of diving into the media side of things in this ufology world, and I'm excited to talk about some of the stuff we've been working on.
Definitely. And that media stuff and the production side of things we are going to get to, because it's a really interesting thing for me especially. I've got a slight media background, nothing like yourself or Jay's and many others, but I've got a big interest in that and that side of the UFO and related phenomena, that conversation. But Jay, before we get to that, a little bit about yourself for anyone unfamiliar with you and your work.
Sure. Well, as you stated, I'm the director of the Experiencer Group, which is a group that I co-founded back kind of in 2020, kind of in 2021. Our custom-built website went up in early 2021. The Experiencer Group is a private, pay-what-you-wish member site dedicated to support, curiosity, and community for those who've lived through anomalous events of any and all kinds. So that's not just UFO, UAP, experiencers or NHI experiencers. It could be anybody that's maybe experienced what people think of as haunting, out of body, near death experiences, precognitive dreams, anything along those lines. It's a wonderful place for me, partially because it's my sandbox and I built it, right? So of course it's going to be awesome for me. But like I really enjoy that the way that members approach it and approach each other on the site, and they really do compare notes. There are now a lot of member groups that have grown up without me even having to necessarily be involved. There's a new group, for example, called Anomalous Anonymous, which I love, which is for people that have had substance abuse and chemical dependency issues, partially arising from the incongruities that happen between day-to-day life and their anomalous experiences. Mm. I mean, it's a very common problem that comes up often in groups, that people have had substance abuse issues after surviving and going through anomalous experiences. So it's wonderful to see that. Book clubs, women's groups, Ask Me Anything sessions, the private site. It's a lot of fun. And then, of course, after that, I started working on a series of conferences with James Iandoli, and then Leslie Kane got involved with that as well, called Inquire Anomalous. So those inquiry conferences have been happening in New York City and online as a hybrid event. We had our fourth one in December, It was great. The in-person tickets sell out every single time, and it happens faster and faster. And I have to apologize to people when they don't see that the conference is happening, because it happened. They sell out so quickly. But that's been a fun wild ride. And now I'm working with Kelly and Jordan Flowers on Ontocalypse Productions, and it's been absolutely incredible. It's a wonderful year to be kind of charting this path with Kelly and Jordan and others that are involved with the upcoming series that we're working on, and I'm really looking forward to it.
You mentioned James Iandoli. I texted him earlier today, actually, a few times back and forward. So hello to James if he gets a chance to catch this one up. Those conferences we'll mention later on in New York, you've hosted real torchbearers for the subject, and I'm not just blowing smoke up your ass, as Americans like to say. They are, and I think it's something that's going to be really relevant to some of the work we're going to discuss with you. Not been able to get to one of those myself yet, very close on one occasion. Stop holding them around Christmas time, you know, for those of us who have young children.
True, you're right.
Yeah, that's for those traveling, it's a pain. But listen, let's talk about the creation of Ontocalypse Productions. If anyone's listening to this and thinks, oh, let's hear about the experiencer group and whatnot, Jay and I have covered that on previous podcasts, including hosting several of the experiencers themselves on a variety of shows. So if you're interested, search Jay's name, search experiencer group in the podcast search bar, and you'll find those chats and conversations. Same on Kelly's pod. She's hosted Jay on multiple occasions as well. So you can certainly check those out, and we won't run over too much old ground. But we do have some listener questions around that sort of stuff later on. Kelly, back to yourself. Ontocalypse Productions, a media production group from yourself, Jay, and Jordan, as you mentioned. What was the thinking? How has this come about? Let's share this with the listeners.
Absolutely. So it came together kind of magically, as things often do when you're doing this kind of work. There were kind of a group of us, most in the New York area. I came in from Ohio, but who back over the summer, there were so many people kind of with the, you know, the whistleblower revelations and the hearings and everything, that there were people, you know, younger people, kind of our generation in the community, who were like, okay, so what do we do? Like, what's the next step, and how do we contribute, and how do we support this movement? And so Jordan Flowers ended up having a bunch of us who were kind of similarly minded. There were like maybe 8 to 10 of us out to his house in Connecticut. And we spent a weekend just kind of sharing ideas and, you know, spitballing and whiteboarding, and kind of out of that, me, Jordan, and Jay found a really natural alignment in both kind of our vision for what we wanted to accomplish in the field. And also, we have really naturally aligning skill sets. You know, Jay is an experienced director and has all of, you know, the amazing contacts that he has in the community, and, you know, the experiencer group. And, you know, I'm definitely more of kind of like a writer and a storyteller. And, you know, my community is mostly more people who are coming to this field more in the last few years, and are kind of looking for that on-ramp and are looking for credible information. And so, like, that felt like a really smart partnership to make. And then Jordan he's our money guy. And, you know, Jordan is somebody who, from day one was like, you know, if people are going to make it in this field, like there seems to be this almost stigma around making money in this field, which is crazy, because then the alternative is that the only people who are working in this field are people who are independently wealthier, you know, maybe being funded in some ways that might be a little secretive. And, you know, if we want independent researchers to grow up in this field and to build the, you know, ufology of the future, we need people to be able to make money in this field. And so Jordan is somebody who's got a great background in business. He was ex-McKinsey and did a bunch of other really interesting things, and an entrepreneur himself. And so the three of us came together and we formed Ontocalypse Productions. The name itself comes from, you know, this conversation that's been a conversation we were having a lot, but is also happening in the community all the time around, you know, ontological shock. And I think the thing that we really wanted the name to capture is that the revelations that are coming out of Washington, you know, plus out of, you know, the scientific world and the philosophical world and kind of across the board, is that we're moving into this space where we're realizing that it's not just ontological shock that we're going to be dealing with, but really kind of an ontological apocalypse where, you know, so many things that we believed about the world to be true turn out to not be quite as we were told. And so, you know, we really wanted to create media that speaks to that problem, and that gives people an answer and a way forward and a way to not just like demand answers from Washington, which is, you know, a very important part of this, but really to find a step forward where like, how do I integrate this into my own life? How do I make sense of it? How do I move forward when I still have a job and maybe kids and all other things going on? Like, how do I integrate this and metabolize this information? So we just moved from there. We're starting with the docuseries. We were lucky to do a very successful fundraising round on that with some fantastic investors who stepped up to the plate for us. And magically, kind of some incredible collaborators have come to the table to work with us. One in particular I'd like to shout out is Mike Rubino, who is a Hollywood film score composer who has worked with like Disney and DreamWorks and, you know, everyone you can think of under the sun. And, you know, he's going to be doing like a bespoke film score for us. And we could not afford him, but he's very generously doing it for what we can afford. And it's been really magical, and it's been so fun, and it's really coming together. And we have some amazing names. We started filming out at Seoul to begin with. We've got, we have Jeff Kripal, who's come on as a consulting producer and is also featured. Whitley Strieber, Diana Pasulka, Mike Masters, Alex Dietrich, the list kind of goes on. And it's been a magical ride.
Certainly sounds it. Do you want to come in on that, Jay, and expand at all, or give any input on your part?
Yeah, sure. A magical ride indeed. It's interesting when you take on a situation like this, because as I'm sure you know, Andy, there's an aspect to ufology and anomalous studies in general that takes place online. And it's a huge part of it. It's the community aspect. It's where people chat about things. But we all know that we can't get all of our information just from YouTube videos or from some random person that sounds like a transformer on Twitter or something like that, right? We have to go farther than that. And so then people start approaching the books, you know, and approaching the documentaries that already exist in the space. But then as people that actually work on these projects and have boots on the ground, that's a different level as well. And so, you know, as your wonderful showmate Dan experienced down in Colombia, you know, and Vinny, having boots on the ground in situations like this produces a kind of accelerant and a kind of growth that can't happen when you're sitting in your living room, or it can't for most people, right? And so I have a years of TV experience in the past, and there's an aspect where in the past, the shows that I was working on, it's fun. And there's like an 80 to 90 hour a week kind of regular pace that happens in a lot of TV shows. And so there's a lot of work hard, play hard, and there's aspects where it can feel like a traveling circus and like a surgical strike team at the same time. And one thing that I was really excited about with Ontocalypse was being able to pace our shoots, partially for budgetary concerns, but also pacing our shoots so that we could go out, really experience something together, and then kind of go back to our corners and process like what we'd just gotten, and then kind of move it forward more as an experience and more as like a conversation between like Kelly and I, for example, and the other on-camera talent that she mentioned. And also bring in the viewer for that in terms of like, how does it feel to be in these situations, and how does it feel to be, to have boots on the ground in a situation like this? So we definitely aspire to have that be an aspect that comes across on screen, and we're looking forward to that.
That's good to hear. I think the UFO topic, and I'm going to stop saying and associated phenomenon, but that can be implied. Okay, so the UFO topic, the representation in the mainstream when it comes to this being presented, you know, as fact, as reality, and documentaries, series, and whatnot, even news reports, is extremely mixed. And I would say more often than not, falls flat in its face for whatever reason that might happen. I think there's a few examples of that. James Fox's documentaries, many would say, are the standard bearer for that sort of stuff. But I think there's a whole lot more losses and wins. So from your point of view, Kelly, I'll come to you first. What are you hoping Ontocalypse can bring that does the topic and the conversation justice and also adds something that little bit different?
I love this question, Andy. I really do. And because this is definitely how we've been thinking things through. I think you kind of, if you don't have a reason to do it, like if you don't have an something that you want to create that doesn't already exist, like if someone else is already doing it, like if James Fox is already doing it and he's doing it better, like let James Fox do it, right?
Yeah.
And and I think that we really did feel like we had a space to speak into here that was unique. One of the things that I think is really exciting about the project that we're working on is that Jay and I have kind of a unique perspective where, you know, Jay and I talk, even before this, Jay and I talked basically every day, and now it's even more so. But, you know, we both have these online communities. And, you know, with Jay's community, he's talking to people often who are like having, you know, anomalous experiences for the first time, or who are suddenly becoming aware of kind of this version of reality, and recognizing that things in their past that they had forgotten or shoved back in a corner somewhere, just like not refused to look at, like now they have the context to begin to examine those things and they're looking for support. You know, and I'm kind of on the other end of the spectrum where, you know, I created my podcast because I did the same thing when I came into podcasting. I was already a huge fan of that UFO show. Like, I love you guys so much. And I love the people who are already in the field. I was a fan of Somewhere in the Skies and, you know, the podcasts are already out there. I wanted to do something a little bit different because otherwise why do it, right? And so like my path has always been, I wanted to create the on-ramp, you know, so that for people who are newer to the field, so then they can graduate, you know, to the other podcasts once they've figured out, you know, kind of gotten a lay of the land, right? And so a lot of people that come to me through my podcast are newer to the subject and they're just figuring this stuff out. And so, but I think what that gave us was like a really interesting starting place where we realized that by nature of just the way these things work, so many of the media projects that have been out there so far, and there's so many amazing ones, obviously, you know, James Fox and, you know, Leslie Kane's UFOs Investigating the Unknown and, you know, Unidentified and so many of these other kind of fantastic programs that have been put out there. A lot of them are just because of where we were in the conversation at the time, were about, you know, making the case that we should even be talking about UFOs at all, you know, like that there's a there, as we say, and that this is real and that this is of note and that we should care. And we really kind of wanted to start at a place where we begin at the very beginning of episode one of like, this is real, this is happening. And so now what? And then the series really dives into that question and speaks directly to the questions and the anxieties, you know, and kind of the emergent amazingness and beauty that comes out of people stepping into that question in their own lives. And so, you know, we want to approach it from a few different angles. We want to talk through, we want to really center experiencers, because so often when we're trying to make the case that we should just even be allowed to talk about this, we end up kind of marginalizing experiencer voices because you don't want to like spook the horse and scare people too much, like right out of the gate. But when you're starting with the premise that this is real, suddenly that opens up a door. And so we want to be, you know, really centering experiencer narratives. We want to be talking with people who are really on the leading edge of this, you know, people like Jeff Kripal, people like James Madden, who's a philosopher whose book we published, Unidentified Flying Hyperobject, back a few months ago, that's really already being hailed as a new classic of the field. You know, these people who are having really interesting bleeding edge thoughts about what this could be. And, you know, and we are going to look at like the government secrecy and stuff too. You know, we have Daniel Elizondo, whose work I think, you know, we're huge fans of, you know, who put out Loose Threads a while ago. That was a really phenomenal piece of research, maybe one of the best that's been done in recent decades. So we have him and James Iandoli also, you know, is coming to the table. And, you know, so we're going to be exploring that side of things as well. And so I think we're just excited to have kind of a breadth and a depth of conversation that hasn't necessarily been had before, at least kind of at this sort of elevated, we're also trying to bring it to kind of an elevated level where it's not just, you know, as fun as it is to just wildly speculate. And, you know, Jay was just here and we like to stay up late and talk about all kinds of stuff. You know, we want to ultimately be able to ground the things that we're putting out there in like, you know, these people have PhDs and here's what they think. So we're trying to really balance all of that and create something that brings something new to the table.
And just, you never mentioned the name of the series previously, and the one you've mentioned, it's The Beyond, UFOs, A New Reality. Still yes. The correct title, yeah, nothing's changed, we're going with that, yeah.
Yes, cool. And thank you for catching that. Yes, The Beyond. Everyone's going to be sick of hearing about it in a few months, I hope.
in a good way, hopefully, yes. that it blows up and goes big. And I think you're right in a lot of what you said there. That conversation I'll probably come back to in terms of experiencers. And Jay, you know, we've talked about that before, and we disagreed online a little while ago slightly on that approach. But that one thing that's missing massively in this whole topic is people being able to talk and disagree, but, you know, still talk to each other and not fall out and actually have a conversation and move forward, because it'd be very, very boring. And I'm sure that's not how all your meetings have gone for in talk clips, where you, Jordan, and Jay have sat and went, yes, great idea, yes, great idea. Sometimes it's not a great idea. Sometimes I get what you're thinking, but it's not right just now, and you move on to something else. But maybe a seed gets grown there and blooms into a different idea, which works and is an amalgamation of everyone else's thoughts. So I think that's just missing from society in general, before I got on my soapbox. But we'll come back to that side of things. And Jay, similar question to yourself from what Kelly said there, but for you, what, with years of experience in TV, you've talked to me about that before on previous interviews, what do you think does work when you're approaching this sort of, you know, this sort of media for the UFO topic, and what doesn't, what are you going to try and avoid?
That's a great question. And we've thought a lot about it. And partially like what Kelly was talking about, you know, centering experiencers is important, partially because the stories are so dang good. You know, you get such amazing stories, like being able to pick through so many wonderful accounts, so many cases. You know, we went down to the Archives of the Impossible and got to, you know, actually handle the communion letters and other docs like this, and being able to really look at some underknown cases. And so a lot of the cases that we're going to be covering on the show aren't, it's not a greatest hits. I think that's one thing that the media landscape has done too much of. And it's like every, you know, each new show comes up and they're all great in their own ways. And they really are, you know, like I really enjoyed Encounters. I thought it was really well produced. And then, you know, at the same time you watch, you know, an episode comes up and I'm like, you know, I know the Ariel, and so, you know, I know, like, I saw Randy Nickerson's movie. I already know this case. You know, there's other examples where it's like, I remember the old John Mack archival footage. I know this case. I don't need to see this case again. And like, yeah, there's an aspect where we're bringing in a new audience each time a show like that comes out. And at the same time, then I'm so used to getting online and then, you know, the 50 to 100,000 people that kind of surround this community are all kind of, you know, moaning and groaning about having seen the same stories. So we're going to be bringing in some more obscure cases that have really amazing qualities to them. We're going to be looking at, we're doing a boots on the ground situation that is kind of a through line through the whole project, that covers an experience or family and a paranormal ranch that's never been talked about on camera before. That's going to be fascinating. And another aspect that we're bringing in here is that we were looking at what, and I want to handle this kind of in a delicate way, because it deserves to be talked about in a delicate way, despite the contention that we're talking about here, is that we're talking about paranormal situations. We're talking about UFO, UAP, and anomalous experience in general. We're looking at kind of this broad landscape of anomalous experience and centering UFOs and UAPs. And that conversation for many years now has been a military focused conversation. Like ever since the days of like Donald Kehoe, you know, and everyone after that, and like, you know, NICAP and APRO, and so many situations and so many UFO groups were really kind of had a bias towards really paying attention to what the Air Force was doing or what Project Blue Book was doing or whatever. And for good reason, for very good reason, because we want those documents out. We want more transparency from that. And that's been a 70 to 80 year process that is still ongoing, right? But then on the other hand, we were thinking about it and we're like, gosh, there's probably a lot of people out there that are into weird stuff that get bummed out thinking about the military all the time. There just are. You know what I mean? There's millions of people out there that really don't like thinking about war. They don't like looking at aircraft carriers. They don't like thinking about this stuff. And one aspect here is that, like, if we're going to, and this kind of gets back to what you were saying about having light disagreements, and you're absolutely right. Like, we need to be able to have kind of difficult conversations. And one of those difficult conversations within ufology that I see is that people can't accept that a UFO show might not have been made for them.
Yeah.
That a UFO show might not have been made for them. I remember, like, when Demi Lovato's show came out, and, you know, whatever to Demi Lovato's show, but, like, she had, you know, an unexplained show, you know, of her own, and, like, of their own. And, like, I'm sure that Demi's fans, some of them were really into that, or people of that generation and stuff like that. And that's fine. And, you know, you see controversies around stuff like that. And, like, I love that there would be a UFO show that's not built for me. Because, you know what? I don't have time to watch everything in this space anymore. And, like, Kelly doesn't either. And, you know, you've got kids and you don't either. And so, but seeing new projects that are a little bit more tailor-made to different contingents or different audiences, or are specifically looking to broaden the conversation by bringing new people into the field. And that's really what we're trying to do here. We're looking at an expanded audience and trying to kind of separate this Venn diagram that's been existing for 80 years, where you to be interested in UFOs or UAPs, you also have to hear about the Air Force all the time. We're not going to do that.
It's interesting to hear you put a figure of 50,000 to 100,000 people in this community. Could be right, could be wrong, but I like that, because I've said many times, too many folks who spend, this isn't a dig, all day on a certain social media site, be it Instagram, probably less so on there, but Facebook, Twitter /X, whatever you want to call it, they think that is the UFO conversation, and it's not. It's, I've said before, it's a long corridor of rooms with all different conversations happening, and it's just one little room with a very vocal minority all making a lot of noise. Most of the other rooms don't even know they're there because it's such a long corridor. And I think you're right that there are many documentaries that go out that, one, you look at and go, I've seen all this before, interesting, but do you know what? And I'm sure Kelly feels the same here. I'm sure if Netflix put Encounters on, I watch it and go, is that for me? Probably not. Interested in the conversation. I know a lot of this stuff. I think the polite thing's always to say these things are well produced. I've used that term many times for documentaries I've not liked. So well produced, you know, the production, oh, excellent. And then two thumbs up. I won't tell you what the rating is. And from there, it's not for me, but there are 200,000 people who stream that and stream it and watch it properly, not, you know, a million that start it and don't stick with it. Maybe 1% of those goes and checks out UFO podcasts. So maybe of those 1,000 or 2,000 people, a few hundred find Kelly, a few hundred find me, a few hundred find Ryan Sprague, and so on. And even then they check out one episode and go, nah, this isn't for me, this UFO stuff. But some of them stick about, some of them get into research, and then you kind of grow the field that way. And I think that's a really good way to look at it, especially Demi Lovato stuff. Not my presentation, not my style of thing, but it drew in a very different audience who are interested in this topic, in the same way that I don't know if, I was going to say BTS, that's a really niche reference, isn't it? Some Korean pop band at their gig turns around with a million fans worldwide and says, we believe in UFOs. A good chunk of them go and find media, blogs, podcasts, you know, old school documentaries, whatever it might be, and it trickles down. What is your audience then? And I suppose whatever one wants to come on this first, maybe Kelly, if you want to start, what is your audience? Because you're going to have to, it sounds like, try and cater to the folks on, let's just say, UFO Twitter, who are looking for something to get their teeth into, something to think about. But Kelly, like you would say in your podcast, you can't make something so hyper niche that we're all going, oh my God, this is so thought provoking. But your average person in the street spends 1 minute and goes, I just can't get this. I don't know what they're talking about. So how are you planning to kind of tackle that problem?
That's a great question. I mean, I think something that we think about a lot is, you know, how do we, and something that, you know, I've learned to really think about through my approach with my podcast is, you know, how do I give people a framework to start with? Like, how do you kind of need to set up the framework that they probably already have, that they've gotten through the media, You need to show them why that framework isn't quite working. And then you need to give them kind of a menu of options of other things that might be going on here. You know, and we don't have the answers. So that's really all we can do, right, is give people kind of a menu of options. And I think that the people who are going to engage most and enjoy our project the most and feel like that this is for them are the people who really like to ask those questions, you know, and who are open-minded and who are willing to kind of wade into the deep end of the phenomenon and ask the bigger questions. And with the understanding that, like, the answers are not going to be easy or obvious. And so, you know, I think that I have been surprised in a really positive way over the last few years with my podcast at the fact that I think maybe I do a lot less handholding now than I used to, sort of realizing that I think in this culture that we're in right now, where everybody has the attention of a TikTok video, that you assume that you're going to have to really walk people through it. But I think there's actually a hunger and among a certain contingent of people that I think is larger than we know, to kind of be challenged, you know, to have their brain, you know, to understand like 70% of something and then have to run it back and be like, what was that? Let me look at that again. Or, you know, to people who, you know, come across a question or a mystery like that and then log on to Amazon and are like, what book can I read about this to learn more? Like, what podcast can I listen to? And I think that for those people, for people who are like really wanting the details of like, you know, what's going on with disclosure and what's going on behind the scenes, like, that's not necessarily what we have to offer with our project. And there's a lot of projects that are great that are doing that. But for us, I think it's more, we're asking the bigger questions and kind of inviting people to go deeper into that mystery with us and to think alongside us about what might actually be going on here in a really kind of human and community-centered way.
Jay, do you want to add to that?
Sure. Yeah, I agree with everything Kelly just said. And, you know, there's a tradition here where it's like, it was really important to both of us to not treat people like they're stupid and to recognize that people are usually brighter than the kind of collective intelligence level that commercials and TV tend to project at. And so we're consciously thinking like we need more smart TV. Like, there needs to be more smart TV out there. We're going to make some smart TV. And part of it is also like, but we need to make smart TV that's not boring. Like, it's important to make smart TV that's pretty exciting, not boring, and is pretty fun. So in that way, there's a great history, you know, within television and film, with older projects like, say, What the Bleep Do We Know and things like that, where documentary projects that have some great visuals, some fun visuals, and really tackle brainy, like crazy, wilded out concepts, while giving you like an audio and visual journey to experience. And that's partly what we're going to be doing here. And so I really enjoy that. I really enjoy the idea that we could be speaking on a pretty high level. And at the end of the day, like, picturing that there's going to be some guys that get home and, you know, slump down on the couch and smoke a bowl and watch our show at midnight. You know what I mean? Like, and that's awesome. I think that's fantastic. You know, it takes all kinds. And so, you know, coming at that kind of blend for an audience is going to be really important. And so when I think, like, who is our audience, I think it's a broad audience. But I think it's an audience that likes to explore, that likes to be challenged, and likes thinking about weird stuff, you know, and likes a good story. That's what we're going for.
One thing I don't like to do on this podcast ever is throw shit. But let's just humor me for a moment, okay? And let's speak generally. What do you both not like to see in a UFO documentary or piece of film? I'll start with mine. I've said this before. I hate poor CGI. If you can't do it well, don't do it at all. And I think, was it James Fox, the Virginia documentary, where there were more drawings and recreations in that respect than there was CGI, and it worked so much better. Don't show me a horrendous, you know that little alien video of the little thing that dancing and does the weird noise online that my kids used to watch for ages. Don't put something that really that bad on, because that turns people off. So that kind of does it for me. Awful music. I get stock footage and stock music is just the done thing in TV and documentary, but there's plenty of options out there these days. That really turns me off. And celebrity talking heads who are just there for the sake of it, when they don't really have an interest in the subject they're talking about. So there's three things right off the bat for me. So from your two professional points of view, what kind of stuff are major turnoffs for you making a UFO documentary that we're definitely not going to see in any Untalkalypse productions?
Kelly, you want to go first?
Yeah, no, because we talk about this too, and we agree with a lot of those things. You know, I mentioned Mike Rubino, our film score composer.
Yeah.
We're really excited that there will be no cheesy sci-fi music in this, you know, in this documentary, which I'm really excited about. I think visually something that we've talked about is just that, like, sometimes it looks like everyone is just like in a skiff or like being held hostage in the basement of the Pentagon or something. And I think that some, you know, we tried to bring people kind of out of that into like a more human context, you know, and we were really excited to be able to go down to that ranch in Texas and sort of get, you know, really kind of sweeping, inspiring visuals of like nature, you know? And I think that that's bringing it into kind of a more human context, I think, is really great. We always joke about the rusty swing noise that you hear in docuseries. So, you know, it's spooky, you know? I think if you have to tell people too much with cues like that, that it's, that's a problem. And, you know, something we've talked a lot about too is, I mean, I agree with you. You know, if recreations are done, I think they need to be done in a really thoughtful way. And something that in particular has always bothered me, and I know Jay and I have talked about this a lot, is just that, you know, a lot of these stock footage sites where you might pull like a video of a UFO or something, they're being made, like there are artists who are just like, this is part of their income stream, and they're putting something out and they're making it look cool. And they're probably basing it on, you know, not their own experience or other people's experiences, but like what they've seen in the movies, what they've seen in media. And so then we kind of have this like self-perpetuating cycle where we're kind of misrepresenting the experience itself by presenting the UFO as something it's not. And I'm passionate about that because I had actually been doing this work for over a year before I realized that I'd had this, like, I knew I'd had one UFO encounter, but I realized I'd had this like second one where I saw something that didn't look anything like, and it was in broad daylight and it was like blurry and it didn't look like a craft in that, like something might be in it. You know what I mean? It didn't look like what I thought of as like a flying saucer, or like a UFO. And so I didn't think of it as a UFO. And so I think it is like important that we be representing. And I think all of that is very innocuous. It's people just, we don't have real footage of UFOs. So you have to use something, right? And so what are you going to do? And so I think that's it's done very innocently, but I think that it ends up kind of subconsciously perpetuating some real misconceptions about the experience itself. And so I think that where we do dive into experiencer narratives, we want to be as kind of faithful to the actual, what that experience is actually like for somebody who's going through it, and not lean on stock photography or videos that aren't really based in reality.
It's an interesting point about that perceptions reality. You know, you show people one thing in Hollywood and it becomes the thing. I'm pretty sure this fact is correct that, you know, people think frogs, if you ask someone to make a frog sound, they'll say ribbit, but there's only one frog on the planet that actually does ribbit, and it's a frog that's only found in Hollywood. So when they were filming frogs for the first time ever, it was this one particular frog, but almost 99% of other frogs, it's like a croak. So ribbit isn't what frogs sound like other than a frog in Hollywood, and that's why everyone thinks frogs go ribbit. So if you present one thing as, here's what a UFO is, here's what a UFO documentary should be, here's what the music's like, here's what the people who follow this are even like, which can be that's one of my other pet hates, sometimes the types of folks who speak on camera, and how that's presented, that can usually be done though in a detrimental way, deliberately. So yeah, all that stuff kind of, it sounds like you guys have considered all that anyway, but those are just some of my rants. Jay, what about yourself?
Oh yeah. I mean, Kelly hit the kind of greatest hits of ours to a large degree. Another one, I think is leaning on the audio from like Gimbal and Go Fast, and stuff like that. Or just like, whoa, got it. there's a whole fleet of them. Like
I took that out of the podcast intro after a certain point because I had never heard that in anyone else's. And then I remember I got a few comments after like a year going, oh, another fucking podcast that's got the gimbal. And I was like, oh, are more people using this? I'm going to take it out. So yeah, I was guilty of that. I was guilty.
Well, but you were the Ribbit. You were the innovator that found the Ribbit, and then you pushed it out there, and then everybody imitated it. Yeah, that's what happened there.
That's all just the echo. Clear. Yeah, you're right. I shouted first. I'll take that.
Yeah. It's true. So, you know, there's that. Like, I mean, you know, some of the stuff, like the stereotypes are there for a reason, and it's because they're awesome. And, you know, for example, with Gimbal and GoFast, people use them all the time because they, you know, they're so indicative of like December 2017 and like, you know, everybody finding ourselves in a new chapter with ufology. Mm-hmm. Makes perfect sense. We had another early rule and we might have to break it. It depends. We'll have to see how it goes. But we had an early rule for the show that was just kind of a thought experiment. But it was like, what if there's a UFO show that never shows an aircraft carrier once? What if there's a UFO show that never, ever shows an aircraft carrier?
Can't be done.
We're right? finding that it might not be able to be done, actually.
We're finding that it's more challenging than you might think. Partially because Alex Dietrich participated. And like the thing was there is that like I think one of the reasons we got Alex, like not just at my conference in December, but for the show, is that I was introduced to her at Seoul, at the Seoul Foundation Symposium. And she was like, oh, you know, there's going to be... we were talking, chatting, and about how we were there to do a TV show. And she was like, oh, cool. Like, what are you covering? And I was like, well, I'll tell you one thing. We're not going to have an aircraft carrier in it. And she just, like, lost her shit. She thought it was so funny. Like, she was, like, doubled over. And, like, it was great because it was my first time meeting Alex Dietrich. And I had no idea whether that joke was going to land at all. Like, it could have been a horrible idea to say that. But I did. And she thought it was really funny. And then we've gotten along great ever since. But because she did participate in it, it has made it much more challenging for us to follow our own rules. But that can be okay, too. You know, you have to, like, finding the show, especially in a situation like this where it's really the first series, it's the first season. You know, you kind of walk out and then you find your legs and you find where you're headed. And so there are aspects, actually, where what Kelly and I and Jordan thought the show was going to be back in like September, August, even November of last year has really shifted over the last months. And partially just by having shared experience together and like going to Seoul and seeing what that was like and doing the Enquire Anomalous conference together in December or going down to this paranormal ranch in Texas, other situations like that, you know, it got a lot into our minds about like, gosh, you know, like, I've been at this for a long time and it's still not quite what I thought it was. And like, where do we go from there? Oh, gosh. So like, as much as we're kind of building the show to be a little bit of a mind screw for the viewer in a good way, it's also been like an amazing amount of like personal growth and thought for us as well. And I look forward to continuing that.
What kind of schedule are you looking at then for some kind of release?
Kelly, do you want to handle that one?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're very excited that we're going to be doing kind of a sneak peek preview of episode one at Contact in the Desert on May 31st. So it'll be on that Friday. I believe it's at 6:30. We could not be more excited about that. And then a few people who are in the docuseries are going to be there with us, like, you know, Whitley Strieber and Paul H. Smith. And so that's going to be really cool. So we're very excited about that. The actual show itself, I don't know, Jay, where are we? We've updated our it'll be out this summer, all three episodes, probably like mid-summer, I think is fair to say.
Yep. And it's three about hour-long episodes is what we're looking at. There's going to be extra material, and we're still trying to figure out whether we're going to play with bonus material or whether we're going to save it for a potential season two.
And but do you know yet how that's going to, how can I consume that? Is it YouTube? Is it a paid platform? Are you trying to get it on streaming?
Mm-hmm. Apple TV and Prime Video are going to be two of the main distributors. We're looking for other world distributors, and that's one aspect. I've got a meeting about that actually tomorrow, and we're going to continue in that vein. But yeah, it's going to be a small price point. It's going to be less than the cost of a pizza, less than the cost of a movie. to buy the whole season. So people can either, you know, pick up the first episode for a couple bucks and see whether it's their thing or not. Or, and if they do think it's their thing, then they can go and purchase the whole season. We did a lot of research into, like, you know, what seems fair, what seems doable, what's a good amount and things like that. And so I think people will be happily surprised about where we're at. Again, this is a self-funded situation. And one thing to think about along these lines, like with James Fox, for example, is that one of the reasons why you're buying James Fox's movie is that you're buying his independence for himself. And that's, like, an incredibly important point that gets lost in the shuffle in a lot of situations, because people will talk about grifting this, grifting that. Here, Kelly and I and you are participating in content online that we're going to throw up for free, right? And we do this week in, week out, month after month. And then, you know, once or twice a year, throwing something up for half the price of a pizza can get so much of the community up in arms. But then there's everybody else that consumes Apple TV and Prime Video and all this stuff, and they don't think twice about it, right? And the deal is that people should, I think, to Kelly's point earlier, if this topic is as important as we think it is, if it's as important as the online community thinks it is, then it deserves to have a level of sustenance and a level of backing and a level of heft. And that can't happen if everybody's doing it for free, right? Because then essentially we're just all street musicians with, like, an empty guitar case in front of us. And how can we be approaching this on such a huge level and doing something that touches on almost every field of science and social scientific inquiry, if we're all just kind of busking, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And even that is, like, considered poor taste or something like that. So in a situation like this, you know, we did get some independent funding, you know, from some backers, but it's a traditional investment strategy. And so, yeah, you know, we've promised them their money back and plus some. And we want to be able to do that too. We want that to be part of the story here, that, like, that people with traditional investment backgrounds can put money into this space and they can make money back. That's important as well. And, like, I'm okay with saying that, because, you know what? Like, I'm a 45-year-old adult, you know?
Yeah.
I'm a 45-year-old adult, and I don't care what some kid says about whether we're punk rock or not. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I've been to thousands of punk shows, and I guarantee that kid that I'm more punk than they are in most cases. And doing the shows like this is about as punk as you can get. It's about as DIY as you can get. And it's about as independent as you can get. Like, we're not listening to any network's notes about what we're doing in the show. And we don't. And at the end of the day, we're not going to give a flying F what other people think about it. This is for us. And it's for people to hear an kind of unadulterated, fresh, independent take that doesn't have a damn thing to do with what the military-industrial complex wants you to think.
Yeah, you're not forcing people to buy it. You're not forcing people to watch it, that they have to do it. There's no taglines of, you know, rent this documentary today and you'll get the truth, because we are hiding all the secrets on this. I seen a cruise I got an email for recently advertising it, you would find out the truth on the cruise, and I was like, don't do that. That's just that just, you know, does a lot more harm than good. And you know what, people can go and do this stuff themselves, and I would welcome anyone who wants to go and do their own research, do their own work, do their own podcast, whatever it might be. There's always a cost that comes along with it, whether it's buying equipment, paying for software subscriptions, never mind the time that goes into it. Depending how people might look at this and think it's shit and nothing, that's fine. Other people like it. Other people like it for free. Other people like supporting it. Kelly, same with your stuff. Jay, same when it comes to the documentary experiencer group. You don't have to like it. Don't have to do it. It's the same as me going to my local supermarket and going, I'm not buying any of this food. I can grow this myself. They're going to go, yeah, you know what? Crack on. You can grow potatoes and all that kind of stuff and tomatoes and veg and sustain yourself. But do I want to go and get the better stuff that's done for me? Then yes, cool, so I go and buy a meal. But do you know what? Do you want the better meal? It's an extra £2.50, but it comes with this and this, and it's a little bit better cheese, and all got different tastes, you know, and value for money to one person is different to the next. So, yeah, I think if people want to support these things, more and more people understand that that's how the world works these days. I, for one, am completely disgusted you're charging for it, and I'll be pirating it as much as possible. Understood. It is what it is, yeah. And do you know what? I think it's such a small minority of folks who do the whole grifter thing online. Really funny, I had one guy, I doubt he listens or watches. If he does, hello, you know. Had a go at me recently for putting a show out the day early and saying it was on Patreon, et cetera, et cetera. And it is, with no adverts and with additional bonus content if people want to sign up on a 2-week free trial. But advertising my own stuff. I made the point, it comes out tomorrow and people jump in and try and defend me and stuff, and they don't have to do that. The guy's bio, he had, here's my Cash App if you want to keep me getting a little high. And I was like, mate, you're not even producing content or anything for anyone back. And you're like, you know, give me dollars to buy weed. Crack on. Best of luck to you. I hope people do, you know, but don't have a go at me for doing this. Like, Jesus, it was funny. But that's amazing. Good to hear. It's going to be out soon. It's going to have some distribution. You mentioned James Fox. He got shafted by going with a company to do his production for him. He made almost no money from the phenomenon. Many folks will claim that to be the best, the go-to UFO documentary right now if you're introducing someone or you're well-versed in the topic. He got nothing from that. I mean, like,
that's right.
Tiny, tiny, tiny amounts. So he'll make more money, hopefully, and deserves to from his next, because he puts in so much time and effort and goes away from his family for a month at a time to Brazil to do real boots on the ground research. So people like yourselves doing this as well, I totally appreciate that, and others do as well. Listen, let's dive into some listener questions, if you don't mind, before we end up running out of time, and then we'll get back to finish off on the conference stuff. So Dave Smethurst sent in a couple of questions for each of you. First off, for Kelly, and I'm going to read you the context to the question as well that he's given. So Dave says, I see many interpretations of The Others by Diana Pasulka, Donald Hoffman, as reworkings of the old Gnostic ideas of us all being part of the universal God consciousness, us having a spark of the divine within us, and our salvation being through transcendence to know God or the others. I worry that we are dressing up old religious or philosophical ideas to explain the phenomenon and how to interact with it. I worry because it just may have better tech than can manipulate reality than we think. And these old approaches may lead to a serious miscalculation of who and what the phenomenon is. Is this something, Kelly, you have considered?
Yes, and I think that's a fantastic question. I think it's complex, because I think that we can see, I won't say that everyone believes this, but I'll say that I tend to think that this is true, is that there is an aspect of this that we can, the nature of at least some types, right, of anomalous experience that we can kind of map onto spiritual experiences, sacred texts from thousands of years ago, and that sort of a thing. And I think that that's important to notice, and that it does bring in a potentially really important wrinkle to the conversation. At the same time, I see people kind of making the same mistake in two different directions. You know, one is saying like, oh, well then that means that like UFOs are literally angels, or angels were literally just UFOs. And I think that like either one of those approaches is reductive and ends up kind of undermining the real question here. So there does seem to be something about this phenomenon that sparks spirituality and religiosity within people, and that we have to consider that anomalous experiences are probably at the root of many of our religious movements throughout history. But, you know, I think as the question is kind of pointing to, we're also dealing with something where, like, if we take, you know, David Grush at his word, we've got physical craft in a lab somewhere. And so we have to ask larger questions. And so I think we just don't want to box ourselves in. I think it's important to notice these patterns, but to not let ourselves get locked in by either privileging some like past worldview or privileging our more like modern worldview. We need to hold both of those in tension and, you know, continue to question what's happening.
Yeah, it's a fair point with the angel stuff, and I've made comments like that as well. But I'm not religious, and I don't know the answers to the UFO phenomenon. But you're trying to interpret an interpretation of an unknown using the interpretation of an unknown and saying, "Well, this is like this." Yeah, but was that like that? Yeah, we don't know. We're just going off of a book from 2,000 years ago. But it gets a bit wacky, doesn't it? But yeah, no, I get that and appreciate that. Jay, question for yourself from Dave. The unspoken consensus seems to be that if we want to get support from the politicians and public for disclosure, you need to stick to just crafts and bodies. If you talk about abductions and hybrids and talking to mantids at the same time, then however true these things are, it will harm if not sink efforts to get disclosure. So reluctantly, we must not talk about what experiencers have been through yet. How far does Jay agree with this, and is there another alternative to it?
Yeah, thanks for that question. I appreciate it. I think that solving the transparency problem, this arguably 70, 80 year transparency problem, or arguably if you take in older texts and maybe what might be in, like, according to people like Diana Basolka, in like the Vatican secret library, for example, you know, we might be having a transparency issue that goes back many centuries. And then it just got another layer of classification, or various layers of classification, once people like the Air Force got involved, right? Mm-hmm. Or the OSS or whatever. And so, you know, along those lines, I don't think that you solve a transparency conversation and problem by stifling and trying to hide other information. I don't think that those work together very well. It's kind of like a do as I say, not as I do kind of situation, right? If you are in high school and you're getting reprimanded by the vice principal, but you know that everybody in your small town knows that this guy gets a little loose on the weekends and has his own problems, you know what I mean? Like, that's, you believe less in that person, right? And in a situation like that, you know, here, you know, we've got a problem where we've been working with this idea of redaction for many, many years. And this is kind of the concept that, like, you know, documents that come out through like the Black Vault or otherwise through FOIA, you know, will have redactions in them, and we are not allowed that information. Right. But that process of redaction has also happened in, say, like spiritual texts, like you're bringing up earlier. Mm. It also happens with people that well-intentioned UFO researchers in the past, that for a while, you know, there are these series of fads where it's like, oh, we're not going to talk about the occupants, we're not going to talk about the pilots, or if there's a case where an experiencer had more than one experience, then an organization might throw their cases out because they were just deemed to be insane. And it's impossible that more than one experience would happen with somebody. So I think that there's a level of just honesty and straightforwardness and vulnerability that needs to come out and can be applauded. And again, this is a situation I thoroughly believe that, you know, aspects like the Grush hearing, or like Fravor going out in front of a small committee of congressmen and it making, you know, some local news organizations or some international news organizations, etc., you know, that has a level of effectiveness. And then there's another level of effectiveness that happens when we talk to each other just as people. Yeah. Because what we're doing is we're relying on each other. And we're relying on a community rather than like basing things around power structures that have been built to suppress information and literally to extract money from us and oppress us. And I don't personally think that hiding like the more embarrassing aspects of myself, like when this person talking about like mantis encounters or something like that. Yeah, there's a lot of inconvenient details among a lot of experiencers. And at the same time, like, there's a lot of personal growth that happens when we can start to have those conversations. And then people like, you know, Congress folks that people don't necessarily agree with, or people that might, you know, go to work in a five-sided building, you know, like those, like we don't have to have as much fear because we can build up with ourselves a better picture for ourselves of what's going on. These are people that have had a hammer for decades and all they see are nails. And I'm not a hammer wielder, and I know a lot of other people aren't as well.
Inconvenient Details is a good name for one of the episodes of your documentary series if you're stuck. Question for both of you, from it's either Smartian or Smartian. I think it's Smartian. I'd like to ask, what is their best guess on the origin of the phenomenon? Short question, but a big one. Kelly, come to you first.
You know what's so funny is that I feel like the longer I'm in this field, the harder that question becomes to answer. I think in general, at this point, it changes constantly, which I think is a good thing. But I'm leaning more towards something that is here, that is present. It doesn't mean that there's not an extraterrestrial component to it, but something that is either exists in some kind of a shadow biome, or it, like some of these words end up being nonsensical when you really dive into them. All of them kind of come back to the same idea that it's something that's here, that it's something that's local, that I think both, I don't think we can deny that it doesn't want us to necessarily know that it's here or that it hides from us. But I also suspect, probably really influenced by, you know, my good friend James Madden and his book Unidentified Flying Hyperobject, that this is also potentially something that, like, we're just not set up to deal with. I think we underestimate. We tend to think of our own human perception and our five senses as being an objective window onto the world. And there's all kinds of evidence that that's not necessarily the case. And so it may be something that just kind of escapes our attention or slips through our defenses in some ways. So, and once again, all of that's just speculation, and it doesn't necessarily point to a really clear origin. It's the question, right? And I think it's my favorite question, but I don't know that I have a great answer.
I'm the same. That fluid opinion, I think, is really important in this, that it doesn't mean you're right or wrong, or you're a bullshit artist, or you've been caught out by someone, because Kelly once said in episode 12 that she believes it's extraterrestrial, but now she's saying it's interdimensional. Well, opinions can change, and you should allow different opinions and ideas to come into your thinking. And speaking to Jay and disagreeing with him on something, but going, actually, he mentioned this, and that is a really good point, and I'm going to consider that. So that's going to change and shape my opinion now. Now I'm going to think what Jay thinks, because he said this. No one should do that. No offense, Jay, but you know, no one should completely flip their opinion based on one person's statement, but you should allow it to influence your own if you want, and kind of have that kind of malleable flubber of an opinion, I suppose we can call it. Jay, what about yourself?
Yeah, similar to Kelly and similar to you. Like, I don't pretend to have any answers here, but like I do think about this kind of this idea of the shadow biome, and you know, this other layer or this hidden realm that we don't necessarily see. And it does seem that from a lot of different perspectives and a lot of different cases, it would point at the idea that at least one, if not more than one form of NHI are taking advantage of proximity to us and taking advantage of some aspect where they can be so close to us, but completely unseen or undetectable. And they can blip in whenever they want and then blip back out again, almost as if they're coexisting in on a radio station that's just a few clicks away from where we're natively existing. Right. And if that's true, and it seems like there's something to that, then it could be like when our ancestors discovered North America and they're like, whoa, it's a whole new land. You know, we come upon the shadow biome, and, you know, people have talked about how nuclear proliferation and things like that may have like spurned some of the more recent waves of sightings post-World War II, right? But, you know, similarly, like, what if we're on the cusp? People talk about like, oh, what if you're on the cusp of destroying yourselves? What if you're on the cusp of AI, all this kind of stuff? Well, along those lines, what if we're also on the cusp of like discovering where this shadow biome is? You know, what if some, you know, some rogue operation that is that prides itself on hidden science that we're not aware of. What if they've already found this shadow biome, right? But like, what if, you know, what if it is like coming upon North America for the first time and you're like, oh my gosh, we discovered it. It's just for us. And then the more you walk around, you're like, oh my gosh, there's these like Navajo people. Who are they? They're like, they just like their structures look completely different. Like, I don't understand what they're saying. Like, everything's foreign here. And then, oh my gosh, over here, there's the Sioux. There's another tribe. They're another tribe entirely. And look at this frog down here that rivets. Like, I've never seen that before. You know, we could be exploring that realm for centuries and still not have a complete taxonomy of everything that might be living in one or more hidden realms along those lines. And that is kind of the best conceptualization that I can work with that helps keep it fresh in my mind without me landing on something that I can't demonstrably prove to be true.
Just to ask you both to expand on it, because I like to try and think of things in simple ways that I can understand them. And Kelly, you're spot on when you say people use words, and I'm really guilty of this, that either don't really make sense or we don't quite have a meaning. You know, when you put quantum in front of everything to make it sound extra special, like I do a quantum podcast. Oh, how's that different to a podcast? Well, it just is, but it's not really. The shadow biome stuff, the closest way I can to really understand that would be something like Wakanda from the Marvel movies, where it's here and it's a real thing, but we just can't see it. When I try to speak to people I work with, when, you know, you mentioned to them, like, maybe something's here already, and they're like, well, where? And, well, under the water, maybe. But what if it was physically here, but we just can't see it because of a better technology? Is that similar in your heads if you had to kind of visualize an artist rendition, yeah, a Wakanda type scenario?
Yeah, I think it could absolutely be something like that. Or, you know, or Jay's example of kind of like the radio frequency that's just like a few clicks over. I think that something like that's definitely possible. And I think that it could even be something like, I haven't gotten deep enough into it to know what I really think about it, but I have been really intrigued by, there's been kind of a lot of talk lately about this idea that plasma under certain conditions could potentially be intelligent. And so, you know, a huge portion, like over 90% of the universe is made up of plasma. And so it could be that, you know, we think of ourselves and our like physical world and our planet and just like our day-to-day lives as being kind of base reality. And we assume that most of the universe operates more or less the way that we do. But what if we're the weirdos? You know what I mean? Like, what if this like 3D environment, the physical body and all of that, what if there's like a whole different way of being that actually is how most of the intelligence in the universe works, and we're the strange ones? And so, I mean, I think that's possible also. And so, and it might even explain why it seems, there seems to be so much curiosity about us and what we're doing down here. But yeah, I think there's a lot of different ways to think about it, and all of them are, in some ways, equally valid, because we don't have great answers, right?
That's what I like to think. In some way, shape, or form, dreams are a part of something, because, you know, that's an access to something else, somewhat totally different conversation for a different day. But I always wonder about that kind of element of things as well. And does that play into consciousness and accessing, you know, very strange. Jay, what about yourself? Yeah, Wakanda type thing.
Sure. You know, I do think that, I think it's probably a both and situation, because when we're talking about something like Wakanda, like it's something that's been very evocative lately is that, you know, in the last year I've, you know, I met Tim Gallaudet, and I hung out with, we met at Seoul. I'd been talking to him before that about the conference in December. And then out there, I got to meet some of his family. I met his mother, like wonderful people, incredible people. And then, you know, the conversation developed a little bit, and then he produced this kind of amazing white paper for the Seoul Foundation. And, you know, it's funny because if that paper would have come out 10 to 15 years ago, you know, people, it would have caused like aneurysms, not just among, you know, the Navy maybe, but like within ufology. I mean, it would have been absolutely crazy. And then here in 2024, people pay less attention to it because it's 13 pages long. and their ADD brains don't allow them to actually read a PDF that's longer than their lease agreement. And that's totally okay. I get that. I understand that, and it's fine. But there are some amazing cases in there. And Tim Gallaudet's been pointing out some amazing cases, and he's been using the public record to point at things. But then, you know, a lot of times with these retired personnel that have been aware of things, all they can do is point to the public record. So when somebody like him points at a situation where he's like, you know, there's a public report of a joint U.S.-Canadian naval exercise that came upon craft on the seabed, and it appeared that there were, you know, non-human intelligences bodies outside the craft, maybe attempting to fix it or to adjust some piece of technology outside the craft, and that it was filmed. You know, I pay attention to stuff like that. Yeah. I think that's fascinating. And similarly, he's been talking a lot about undersea anomalies that seem to be areas where there might even be architecture under the sea, or kind of obscured architecture to the Wakanda point around Catalina Island and other situations like that. And I think that's fascinating, right?
Yeah.
Because we've been talking for years, like, is there a base undersea? And a lot of people think that there might be multiple bases undersea, or at least some kind of a portal or some kind of like a hiding spot. And I love that idea. It's tantalizing. What happens in Antarctica? You know, like the crust, you know, and the surface of this planet is... People will point out all the time that, yeah, we explore that, but we still don't understand that completely. Mm-hmm. And then there's everything else. And people like Kevin Canoes have pointed out, like in his Soul Talk, that it would be more likely often for like a space exploring civilization to learn to hide undersea, or to learn to go under the surface. Because in a lot of situations through space, we don't like, that surface area is not as safe as ours is, as evidenced by just the other planets in our solar system looking like they've been in 1,000 school fights. Right. So, I think that all options should be on the table. I want to find that other radio station. Maybe there's 20 other radio stations, but I also want to find Wakanda too, for sure.
Yeah. That's fair enough. So on that, you make a good point when you mention, and I'm going to totally forget what you just said there, but it was a nice segue if I remembered it now. So the conversation around underwater bases sounds ridiculous, sounds absurd, sounds like a nonsense. I find it fascinating, but it's something that if I'm talking to, again, friends in work, and we talk about UFOs, and I try and do it a little bit differently, that can be a real turn off for them. You know, when you say, what if they're underwater, and it gets a little bit, what, really, where? And it can be that they're not ready for that kind of conversation. So on that, multiple listeners on the Patreon kind of brought up a question, and they had a little discussion off the back on it. I want to ask you both this question, and I think it's fair, especially for those who are still trying to come to terms with the experiencer side of the phenomenon. But this applies to all aspects of the phenomenon, like I say. How do you go about personally trying to distinguish whether someone's experience is genuine, potentially not genuine, either fabricated or the result of a psychosis, mental health disorder, because that's a real fine line to walk. And I do think to both extremes, one, just poo-pooing everyone's experience or sighting, you can't do that. But on the other hand, it's just as dangerous to go along and say everyone's sighting's genuine, everyone's experience genuine, because it's not going to be the case either way. So I'll come to you first, Kelly, if you want on that one.
Yeah, I mean, this is a fantastic question, and I think a really, really important one. And, you know, the thing that I have come to in my own, because I struggled with this when I came to the field too, is that I've kind of gotten to a place where, in general, I don't really try to assign any kind of a truth value to any particular story. Like, I listen. And I tend to be a trusting person in that I believe that most people are communicating their experience honestly to the best of their ability. But there's a lot of complications with that, you know? So the phenomenon is very tricky, and it can mess with our perception. And even, you know, there's all kinds of cases where, you know, people saw multiple people at the same time saw something, but they saw something different, right? And so I think that if we're getting too stuck on any individual person or any individual detail and trying to say, well, like, this is definitely true and this absolutely happened as described, that we're kind of missing the boat. Because at the end of the day, like, there's no way to really evaluate someone else's subjective experience. You know, like, I could tell you today that I saw a kid bouncing a red ball, and like, how do you verify, like, how do you know I'm telling you the truth? Like, you have no mechanism. You kind of like either believe me or you don't.
Balance of probability. Yeah, you know, maybe you did. Yeah, why would you lie? That's completely right. Reasonable. Yeah,
totally. And so I think it's just a, you know, so I think to kind of keep it open, and I think where I have found a lot of value is in listening to a lot of different experiencers tell their stories, because I'm never going to be able to suss out whether or not any one individual is telling me the absolute unvarnished truth. But I can, over time, listen to a lot of stories and start to see patterns emerge and start to see things that are in common. And that's something that then I find value in, that gives me not an answer, but it gives me a place to start asking better questions. And so I think that it's hard to stay in that ambiguous place. You know, I listen to people and I trust people, but that doesn't mean that like I'm assigning a hard truth value to whether or not what they're telling me is like the absolute objective truth. And it's harder to stay in that ambiguous place, but I think that ultimately we get further in the conversation when we stay open-minded in that way.
I've said before, just before I come to you, Jay, on the same question, my own sighting, the Ferris wheel type UFO, is ridiculous. Right. I remember it vividly. It doesn't make sense. If someone told me that five people saw it, it was in a really built up area, not in a field, not miles away from a town. It was right in the middle of a proper suburban area, loads of houses, playing fields, you know, football stadium, school, high-rise buildings, all of that was there, busy roads, reasonable time of the evening. It just sounds a nonsense, but that helps me when I hear other people's stories. I'm always going to have that inbuilt. Do I believe them myself? Maybe, maybe not. I don't know, but I have to attribute the whole I don't know to it. There's a whole balance of probability. Like I say, that's just me, and I will assign a probability to things. But when it comes to experiences, sightings, as ridiculous as they might be, and this even goes as far as one of those documentaries I talk about where some woman claimed to have had alien eggs implanted inside of her and taken, and I find that a real hard stretch to believe. However, what's the difference to what I saw? Would she believe that? So, yeah, you have to keep that kind of level of open-mindedness about it. But Jay, same question to yourself, mate.
Sure. Yeah, I appreciate the question. It's a good question. And yeah, I think what Kelly said about patterns emerging from listening to more accounts is absolutely true. I mean, I've listened to thousands and thousands of people now through the experiencer group and outside of the experiencer group. And a lot of them in recent years in face-to-face situations, right? Or in group support situations. And one interesting thing is that, you know, there are a lot, like in your case, Andy, where a lot of people, if they're coming to you and they're doing kind of a straight report of what they can recall about the situation and they don't edit out any inconvenient details, it's usually, like yourself, it's usually weirder than what you would want it to be.
Yeah.
It's there's an element that's vulnerable. There's an element that's embarrassing. There's an element that's challenging. That's often the case. And the thing is that like those kinds of stories, like yours, or like the one where Kelly said, like, she didn't even think of it as a UFO because it didn't look like a structured craft. You know, those aren't stories that are going to make people rich. Those aren't stories that are going to make you popular. Those aren't going to be stories that necessarily go over well at the Christmas dinner table, you know, with family or something like that. And so in situations like that, I tend to listen more, you know. I think, you know, Hal Putoff, Jacques Vallée, and many other people have had a variation of saying, like, if if somebody comes to you with a UFO story and it makes sense, don't believe them, you know? And I think that there's something to that, where I do come to situations and conversations from a position of trust and openness and wanting to listen without judgment. And, you know, that's an important thing within the vetted community of the experiencer group, for example. But it is a vetted community. And there are you know, volunteers and members that go through people's application to join the group. And sometimes somebody will write in, and I don't want to assign a value to it, but like there are situations where you recognize that people are in a position of high stress or having severe mental health issues that need to be addressed. And I know from personal experience that I can speak to other experiencers, and I can even speak to experiencers that have, like everybody does, some mental, you know, challenges, some anxiety, maybe some depression, situations like this. There is a vast gray area when it comes to, are you an experiencer or are you just having a mental health issue? You know, because if you've had serious anomalous experiences, there's a damn good chance that you've also had some mental challenges along with that, just in terms of like how to reconcile that with day-to-day life. So, you know, that's to say that I would say like maybe that it's a very small amount of people that approach me or approach our community from a position where they're either clearly having a mental health emergency. That does happen, but even less so are people that seem like they're lying for the purposes of infiltration or for whatever reason. I think that partly that's because if you're approaching a community that's known to have a bunch of like people that have been around other experiencers quite a lot,
yeah,
or people that might even, you know, be gifted with like precognitive dreams or like, you know, extended sense perception in some cases, like serial liars don't tend to approach communities like that for whatever reason. And I think that's great. I think that's fantastic. You know, having a couple like wonderful old psychics around tends to help things out quite a bit. And do I have to believe those psychics every single time?
No,
sure. But I do. I think that openness and communication is important. And to the point of the original question, you know, there are going to be a lot of scientists that study, say, like, that are more in the physical sciences that would more appreciate having a metamaterial in their hands, that are never going to listen to a case like mine or your situation or Kelly's situation. And that's fine because there isn't some cool, you know, metamaterial that came out of the situation. But then there are folks like anthropologists that are fascinated by situations like this, or your psychologists or psychiatrists or people that really study social sciences and social studies. That, you know, there's a lot of terrain there that can and is getting covered and will be covered in the future, where, you know, we won't have to be using our intuition and just our sense of the connective nodes between experiences to get at the bigger pictures. You know, like, we're working on professionalizing and kind of expanding this field and working on the stigma issue, so that other people can come in from other disciplines and give us more tools to be able to vet maybe better than we have in the past.
And I think it's such a big topic. It invites such a wide range of people. And you've got your folks who like your nuts and bolts, your folks who like your spiritual side, your folks coming into this brand new who don't even know what they like yet, you know, to Kelly's point, who are just like, what is this? And, you know, where am I going to land on it? I'm spinning the bottle and seeing where I go. And I think when I've done some of the listener call-in shows, some of the comments online can be, you know, that caller who said about their experience with X, Y, and Z, that was a lot of crap. That never happened. That was nonsense. But you get so many more, or even the same amount. I won't attribute false values to it, but people who will get in touch and say, you know, that really strange sighting, I had something really similar. Or, you know, when someone woke up and had that kind of odd being in their bedroom, but it done this. people said that was bullshit, but actually I had something really similar happen to me. And it's that whole thing of patterns tell stories, you've both alluded to, and hello to Klaus and Garrett. I'm stealing their podcast name for a second there. But it's true, and I think there's something to that. So it's a very fair answer, I think, from both of you. So thank you. Last couple of questions before we wrap up, folks. Appreciate your time. Question from Cams for Kelly. Since you released the episode about your personal experiences, how has that affected your podcasting, having been a respected podcaster in the field for a while now? Cams also asks, do you planning having multiple documentary series like the one you're planning now, or is it a one and done? I imagine it's not a one and done, but I'll let you both answer that.
Yes, thank you. It's been an incredible experience, actually. And, you know, Jay is somebody who was fielding a lot of those calls from me before I released the episode, because it felt like a huge leap to kind of come out of the closet in that way. And it's a process that he's been through very publicly also. And he's like, it's going to be fine. And it was fine. I think that, you know, I don't claim to have any answers. I tried to just speak as like openly as I could about what happened and the process that I went through of kind of coming to terms with it and thinking through what it might have been and being really open about the fact that I don't know what it was and that I still don't know what it was. And what's been really beautiful about it is like, yeah, I've gotten a couple emails, I've gotten a couple reviews where people were like, this show used to be good, but now it's crap because, you know, she went off the deep end. And like, that's fine. You know, like you're talking about earlier, like not everything is for everyone. And like, if where I'm at right now, me speaking authentically, you know, from my heart, from my own experience, if that's not resonating with somebody and that like, that's okay. You know what I mean? Like there's a whole world, a whole internet full of fantastic content that someone can go and find something that does speak to them. And so like, I'm really comfortable with that. But for the most part, what I did get was hundreds, maybe even over 1,000 at this point, if I'm being honest, emails, DMs, messages, comments from people who said, you know, thank you so much for saying that. Something similar happened to me. And that has been such a beautiful thing because when I went through that experience, my immediate reaction after it happened was profound grief. Like I started sobbing because I felt like this was something that was going to build a wall between me and the rest of the world and between me and the people that I love. And the isolation of it and that I wasn't gonna be able to talk about it and the fear that I was crazy was so overwhelming. And I'll never forget what that felt like. It was like one of the saddest moments of my life. And so to kind of have gone through this process and then to come forward with it and to have so many people be like, yes, that happened to me too. So like, and realizing that fear that I had that this thing would make me alone was like unfounded. And that was a really special thing. And to know that hopefully I helped a few other people realize that they also aren't alone and that there is life after something like that and you can integrate it and that it can actually be a really beautiful thing. And so it's been a fantastic experience and I'm glad I did it. And I'm grateful to Jay and some of my other experiencer friends who kind of held my hand through that process as I stepped forward. So.
If you haven't, and you're listening to this now or watching it, and you haven't left a review of Kelly's or my own or anyone else's, take a few minutes, leave a 5-star review, go and find Graham Rendell's books, find some authors and leave them reviews because it does make a difference and help out. I did get a 1-star review the other day and I've had quite a few of these where it's, for example, this is a 5-star podcast, but I don't like the outro. Change that and I'll leave a 5-star review. 1-star. it's like, come on, you could have dropped me an email. But yeah, it's each to their own. But yeah, they do help out. Right.
Oh, and I should answer the other part of the question. I apologize.
I was just going to say, yeah.
Yes, yes, yes. There is more coming, and I apologize because I really thought it would all be out by now. But you know, in a lot of ways, I think docuseries, like making a docuseries, is like having a baby. Where like, if you really knew how much work it was before you did it, you'd be a little more scared going in, but you don't necessarily know what you're getting into. So we have just been up to our eyeballs in work with the docuseries in the best way possible. I'm having the time of my life, and I'm so proud of what we're working on. But there are 2 more parts to that series. The story gets crazier. It involves another experiencer who I didn't know at the time, who my life became very tied to for a time. And I can't wait to share that story. And those two parts will be coming out. It's just like really impossible to say right now exactly when that will happen, but it's coming. And as soon as I can get it out there, I'll get it out there. I just really want to do it justice. So I've got to take things kind of one step at a time.
Final listener question. I had a lot more sent in. Some of them you've both answered in the body of the interview and stuff as well, but we'll keep some for another time. But this one to both of you from Timothy. My question is, since having your own experiences and then discovering other folks within the community sharing your experiences, do you believe that this is some kind of spiritual movement, a possible birthing of a new religiosity, or is it some sort of disclosure being brought forward by a higher intelligence, or something completely different? Jay, we'll come to you first on that one.
Sure. Yeah. I appreciate the question. It's a thoughtful question. I believe I'm not like, I think the best formulation is I'm not exactly sure what to believe. Just at the outset, I do think, you know, to be perfectly frank, I think that so many people have been approached in such specific ways from the perspective of non-human intelligence encounters, close encounters, that there does seem to be a kind of grassroots door-knocking campaign on the from the perspective of at least one other form of intelligence. And I think that part of that door knocking campaign isn't even necessarily intentional. You know, sometimes people get a glimpse of something that they're probably not supposed to see, right? And so I am not sure how concerted of an effort that is on the part of the wide variety of NHI that people encounter. And of course, towards the idea of what Kelly was talking about earlier, there are tricksters, and there are elements where five people might be in a room and they might see something appear or present very differently to each of them. So, you know, when it comes down to, well, what's the message or what are they trying to get across or something like that, it seems that we're getting approached by a wide range of intelligences, or even a wide range within several different cultures. Because if somebody, you know, and knocked on the door, if you answered the door and, you know, it was Graham or it was you, Andy, or Kelly, or, you know, or Klaus or anybody else from the online community, they would come to you with a different approach, no matter what they were trying to do. Right. And that kind of tracks with how people receive some of these encounters. And when it comes down to the spiritual and religious question, you know, we don't know exactly, we don't know how to wrap our heads or our arms or our hearts around the specific encounters that happen. But one thing that I've been amazed by is how people choose to process them and how people can like approach what's happened to them and then find ways to grow, right? Ways to grow in terms of like how they look at the world, how they look at their loved ones around them, how they look at themselves. And there is a strong spiritual component to that. And that can happen in all sorts of situations. And maybe one of the uncomfortable and inconvenient truths in this is that you don't have to be a member of any particular religion to find yourself in a challenging situation and find spiritual growth from it. So that could happen if you fall off a cliff. It could happen if you almost get hit by a car. It could happen if you get struck by lightning, or maybe it happens if you see a ghost as well.
Yeah. Kelly, do you want to follow that answer?
Yeah, I think that's a great answer. I agree with all of that. And I think it's complicated. It's so hard sometimes to talk about spirituality, and in some ways I need to like talk about it from like my like what I think, because I think it's so subjective. But something that's a challenge for me is that this has been a spiritual experience, and I would characterize what I've undergone through the past few years since the experience that I had described in my podcast as kind of a spiritual awakening. And it has transformed me. It has transformed how I think about myself and my purpose in the world, and how we think about the value and purpose of other human beings. And it is, and I'm profoundly grateful for it. It's been a very, very positive experience. And I've also had so many experiences over the last few years. And like Jay has been central to many of them, where like, it seems as though not only is that happening for me, but that I'm meeting so many other people for whom they have kind of been flipped on in that way in the last few years. And it seems like we have work to do together. And it seems like we come together through kind of stunning synchronicities and coincidences that like don't seem to make sense. And then even weirder stuff happens. Like I've had experiences where I've had extraordinarily vivid dreams about something very specific happening to Jay. And then I wake up and it's Jay calling me on the phone to tell me that thing that I just dreamed. And like that, those aren't experiences that I had before. And so it's hard for me in the flow of my everyday life to deny that there's something that at least my experience of it has been something spiritual that's connected me to something that I, in my own understanding, would characterize as maybe even divine. But at the same time, there's a part of me that's still the skeptic. And there's a part of me that questions, like, what even is spirituality? And what is that impulse that we have? And what is it about the anomalous that kind of like wakes us up and re-engages us in certain ways and redirects our entire lives? Because like I've walked away, my career was everything to me. And I walked away from it after 15 years and just walked away. And now to start a UFO podcast, like everyone in my life thought that was like absolutely insane. And it sounded insane and I couldn't justify it any other way. And yet here I am and my entire life has changed. And so, you know, I'm both in it and living it and grateful for it. While also there's always like this tiny piece of my brain that's outside of it and being like, what is this? Like, what is happening? And I never want to lose that part, actually. I think it's really important to never like fully drink the Kool-Aid and to always kind of keep that one part of yourself open and to radical possibility and mystery. Because the truth is, I don't know what's going on here. And my own feelings about it and my own interpretations of it are very vulnerable and could be knocked over at any time by a different data point that suggested otherwise. And so I really try to like live in that space.
I think I've learned through life to never get too high or too low with anything, try and sit in the middle all the time. And yeah, it's got its ups, it's got its downs, but here we are. But listen, you've both been fantastic with your time. Let's finish off talking about this year's Contact in the Desert. Kelly, you mentioned it earlier. It is happening this year from May 30th till June 3rd at the Renaissance Esmeralda Resort and Spa in Indian Wells, California. The event is in person and being live streamed as well. Tickets at contactinthedesert.com. If you want to kick us off, Jay, what's your role at the event this year?
Oh my gosh. Well, they do a great job of throwing people at all sorts of stuff at Contact in the Desert. And so I'm going to be, like I did last year, I'm going to be running what they're calling this year the Experiencer Group Sessions, where we're going to have as many as 40 people or so in a circle. It's not really for people to just watch. It's for people to participate in. And it's for people to be able to tell their stories without being judged and to be able to share and compare notes. I'll be doing a session like that each day at Contact in the Desert. I'm also going to be participating with Kelly on a podcast episode. I'll let her talk about that. I'm going to be leading a panel discussion for contact experiencers on Sunday. That's on Sunday morning, bright and early, in the Crystal Ballroom. It's a great space. I led a panel there last year, and I'm excited to be back doing that with guests like Whitley Strieber and Travis Walton. That'll be a real wild time. I'm thrilled that Whitley has, you know, really become kind of a mentor and friend to people like me and Kelly, but it'll be my first time meeting Travis, and I'm really looking forward to that. That'll be awesome. And then I'll let Kelly talk about what's happening again on Friday night, which she touched on earlier.
Yes, so we are going to be doing the premiere of the Beyond. There'll be a sneak peek of episode one, which we're so excited about. Jay and I just spent this whole last week at my place in Cleveland, really banging that out. And we're can't wait to show you guys what we've been working on. I think it's really special. I know I'm biased, but I think it's really special. So that'll be on Friday night. We're so excited about that. I will also be hosting what I'm told is the first ever Women in Ufology panel with, you know, names like Linda Moulton Howe and Yvonne Smith and a bunch of other great researchers and people in the field. So I'm really honored to have that position, and I really can't wait for that panel. I think it's really exciting, and it's kind of a dream come true to be able to do that. I also will be doing a lecture of my own on kind of like deconstructing, you know, the UFO lore, that a lot of which is coming out of learnings in my own perspective shift that's come through, you know, as Jay was alluding to earlier, kind of the on the ground, you know, boots on the ground nature of the work that we've been doing, and how my thinking has really evolved through making the docuseries. And so I'm excited to share that. And then, as also he said, we're also going to be recording for the first time ever a live episode of the UFO Rabbit Hole on Friday as well. And Jay will be joining me for that. So it's going to be an insanely busy weekend. I'm so excited to be doing it. And I think it's going to be just like a fantastic time. And I've been really looking forward to it.
Well, I'm sure that'd be a lot of fun, whether live streamed or in person, if you can get there. I've said before, I wish I could be out there. It's a little bit further away for me than most folks, but it'll be a lot of fun and getting to meet people like yourselves in person. I know Jay has said, do not approach him. It's £50 per autograph. And no picture. No. But yeah, it's great to go up and talk to folks at these events and get to meet people, and the little avatars you've spoken to for years suddenly come up and say, hi, I'm such and such. And you get to kind of share that kind of few minutes, which is always nice. And personally for me, this isn't, again, blowing smoke up anyone. I'm glad to see you're both doing an event like this, because I've said for too many years, too many, especially big events, have dined out on the same names, the same faces, and not always, for me, just opinion, personally, some not so credible ones that haven't moved the conversation forward have basically been stuck in the same spot, you know, treading water. And it's nice to see not even necessarily younger folks, but people with fresh ideas, fresh opinions, fresh voices, be able to kind of change and mold the conversation, because I think it definitely helps. Some people might not like what you've got to say, some people might like what you do, but others will be hearing it for the first time, and you can change a lot of different viewpoints in that way. So it's always a good thing for me.
Thank you. We're excited about it.
Yeah, listen, and you're going to have to make it out to one of these, Andy, because we have to hang out, man. I think we're long overdue.
Yeah, I'm going to try my best. My wife has told me I think I've got permission at one point this year to get out, so I'll have to pick and choose. But I'll do my best. Enquire Anomalous, got anything planned for this year?
Though I for my own sanity, I'm going to choose not to think about it until we deliver the show.
Okay.
After that, there's been some loose plans. I've gotten some things in mind. I've talked to a couple people. But we'll be able to talk about that further down the line this year. Absolutely. Looking forward to that.
Awesome. Well, listen, go check out Experience Our Group if that is something you feel you will benefit from. Link will be in the description. Kelly, you don't need to advertise, but the UFO Rabbit Hole podcast links will also be in the description as well. If you've came over from Kelly's podcast to listen to Kelly on here, hello. Nice to meet you. Hopefully you've understood the accent. And best of luck to both of you, and hopefully have you both back on very, very soon.
Thanks so much, Andy.
Absolutely. It's always a pleasure, Andy. Thanks so much.
That is all for this episode. Thank you very much for tuning in. Don't forget to leave the podcast a review on your chosen platform. Apple and Spotify do make a huge difference to the algorithm. If you're checking the show on YouTube, please don't forget to like and leave a comment on here as well. Any sharing you do is very much appreciated on any social media platform. And finally, you can listen to shows ad-free and sponsor-free in their glorious full versions by subscribing for less than the price of a coffee on Apple, Spotify, just search That UFO Podcast Premium, YouTube, you can sign up and be a member, or you can do that through patreon.com. Thank you very much for listening, folks. It wasn't a TikTok.
back and not quite a saucer, more like a hubcap designed by Chaucer. A little baroque and quite steampunk, like Alice was playing bass for the Parliament of Funk. The little fucker hovered right inside of my window.